I am calling the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee to order. Today we will hear from the Early Learning Division on hub matrix and monitoring. On Tuesday, March 7th, we have a presentation from Early Learning Division on funding and outcomes. The committee will have discussions following these presentations to evaluate what we have heard so far and any remaining concerns, questions, or gaps. We have DHS and OHA here to answer questions. Fiscal will be here on the 7th, and everything's on OLIS, right? Okay, so with that, I will, so this is the informational hearing, right? I will open an informational hearing on early learning hub matrix and monitoring. David Mandel, come on down.
You're the next contestant.
That's right. We have a surprise for you.
We do. Choose door one.
Vice Chair Palooza, members of the committee, for the record, David Mandel, acting Early Learning System Director, and it's been a full week since I've been here, so it's really nice to be back.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
He was having withdrawals.
Yeah.
Yes, and I know that Chair Lively spent the entire morning with me this morning, so he decided he had enough, obviously. So.
Yeah, we weren't supposed to tell you that, but yeah, that's absolutely right.
Today I want to talk about three things, the hub metrics, our hub monitoring process, and also the hub system evaluation. Before I get started, I also just want to say that, you know, particularly around the hub metrics, I think this is one of the most challenging, it's both one of the most important and challenging topics. And to be honest, today, in addition just to walking through what we've done, if the committee doesn't mind, I just would also like to share some of my opinions with you about that work and the state of that work.
Yeah, if you'll just be sure to note that it is when you're saying your opinions and... That'd be great.
I will do that.
Thank you.
I think it'll be evidently clear.
Okay. All righty.
When he says, in my opinion.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm going to share with you a couple slides that, you know, we've already seen, but you've already seen before, but just to remind you that, you know, the role of the early learning hubs is really to bring together the various partners that support children and families, traditional early learning programs, K through 12, human services, and also the business sector, to really organize a shared conversation about what is the focus population in the community, how to reach that focus population, identify those gaps, and then with the public dollars we put into that, also make investments in communities to achieve those ends. So the hubs are really not a direct provider of services to children and families. There are a couple places, particularly around with that coordination role, where they get a little bit closer to that. And that, I think, really has some pretty important implications for both how we think about what are the appropriate metrics for them, how we measure and assess what they're doing, and particularly do so in a meaningful way, given their kind of current state of development. Just as a reminder, the hubs work created by the legislature in 2013 as part of House Bill 2013, and that legislation also basically authorized the Early Learning Council to adopt performance metrics for the Early Learning Hub. So that's a council responsibility by statute. Back in 2014, I believe, the council created an ad hoc hub metrics committee that was composed of hub leaders. And to be honest, when that first hub metrics committee was created, there were only three or four hubs that were actually already in existence. So it was a pretty small set of hubs that were part of that first hub metrics committee, just because of that timing issue. But also Early Learning Council members, Early Learning Division staff and hub partners were part of that. The current metrics were then adopted by the council, and this slide is wrong. That was January 2015, not 2016. My apologies for that mistake. One of the first things that the council did is adopt a set of principles to sort of guide the adoption of metrics for early learning hubs. And I hate reading slides, but I want to walk you through these. I think these are really great principles and great work the committee did reflect the metric should reflect the impact of hubs across goals in a way that is focused, transformative, and clear about where the hubs have true impact. The metrics should show a meaningful difference for children and families in the community. They should reflect the necessity of collective action, fostering engagement from parents and community-based organizations, as well as the human services, K through 12, early education, and the private sector. They should reflect the stages of development with a logical progression towards higher level outcomes and goals. This was really something that the committee thought a lot about. They should reinforce a focus on reducing disparities between target populations. They should support a strength-based approach to the work, and they should have a data source that is readily accessible, reliable, and valid. And I will slightly enter into opinion again. I think these are a really powerful set of principles, and the honest answer is that not a single, I would pretty much almost none of the metrics could meet all of these principles at once. And that's just a real challenge that we faced. And I think that wasn't because we weren't creative in thinking about the right metrics, but I think there's a real challenge why it's really difficult to get metrics that will do all of these things at the same time. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So started my editorializing already.
Sounded good.
So what we did is we organized the metrics around those three shared goals that are the same goals for the council, for the division, and the hubs: early learning system aligned, coordinated, family-centered, children are supported, and inter-school ready to succeed, and families are healthy, stable, and attached. We also, the committee also very intentionally tried to separate short-term indicators where we felt there was an opportunity for the hubs to realistically make some progress in a two-year period, given that's the contract cycle, and also develop some medium and long-term indicators and measures that show progress in achieving the outcomes that can be demonstrated in that longer 3 to 5 year period. And that's probably even a little bit too short a time frame for some of that work. I'll walk you through a little bit now of what the current set of metrics that were adopted in 2015. So as you'll see in these, I'm not going to read all of these around. You know, these are not, for the most part, these are not quantitative measures for the early learning system, line coordinated and family-centered. And I think that's really just speaks to the nature of that kind of work. So at the so if one of the key foci of the hubs is to really bring together the sectors, what is the evidence that that work is starting to happen? And so you'll see for this part there were actually quite a few process measures that we asked hubs to look at. For the short-term measures adopted around children are supported to enter school ready to succeed, we had the hub has demonstrated shared activities among early learning providers, families, and K-3 partners. Two, an increase in the number of children from our key programs served by a hub, they're on a waiting list served by a hub partner program. So the idea behind this metric was, if one of the roles of the hubs is to do that coordination work, are we seeing in communities that they're starting to share those wait lists and do that work? An increase in the number of Spark or QRIS rated providers serving hotspot and communities of color, increasing the number of children served in those hotspots. So the idea was, as a state, as we're trying to increase the number of quality child care opportunities through that work, is there an opportunity, what's the role of the hub in developing a focused and strategic plan of identifying those providers that serve the kids that we do want to serve, and working with those providers to make sure that that happens. And then increase in the percentage of children who receive a developmental screen before the age of 3. And this is, I'll take a second to talk a little bit about this metric, because I think this is one that also shows some of the power and challenges. One of the things that the Hub Metrics Committee looked at in trying to find metrics for the early learning hubs is where's their metrics that gets at shared work, and in particular, where could you adopt a metric that was a metric for another system to reinforce that work? So this is actually one of the CCO metrics, but one of the challenges for this one is that what is our data source? Our data source is CCO Medicaid billing for developmental screenings. So we have a very accurate data source for it. It pushes that connections with the health sector, but it completely misses all the developmental screenings that hubs are also working on in community settings that aren't part of that data source. Similarly, one of the metrics that was adopted was to increase the percentage of children enrolled in kindergarten before the start of school year. And part of the thought behind that metric was, again, how do you get at things that focus on collaboration? So I think the intent was less that, so we do know it is important for schools and makes a difference if children are enrolled in kindergarten before the start of the school year, and we hear from schools that there's a lot of children who show up after the start of the enrollment day. But part of the focus of that metric was also that's work that can only happen if an elementary school knows and is working with the early learning partners in its community to find out where those kids are and to make those connections. And then finally, we had the measures around children living in healthy, stable, and attached families. Increasing the percentage of children in employment-related daycare who are in a SPARC-rated program, increasing the number of children and families served by DHS through TANF for child welfare who are receiving early learning parent and education or family support services, and increasing the percentage of children on OHP who make it to 6 or more well-child visits by 15 months of age. Again, I'll point to the second one here. The intent was, if part of the role of the hub is to really build those cross-sector connections, how do you get at that? So I think this is an example of a metric that points at some really important work to happen, but one that we don't know how to measure, and we don't know how to measure because we're trying to build connections across systems. And until those connections are built, it's very hard to do data measurement across systems. So as I said, I really think that the hub metric principles that were adopted are really powerful, but we have the challenge that given the reality of the work, it's very hard to actually have metrics that both get at that key cross-sector work, have those reliable data sources, and are the things that a hub feels like it can move in a reasonable amount of time. Right now, we are in the process of re-looking at the current metrics with the hope to be able to have revisions to the metrics for the next contract cycle. Just to give you a little technical detail, we moved the contract cycle for most of our contracts to start September 30th, so there's a little bit of planning time between the end of the adopted legislative budget and actually when a new contract goes into effect. The council created a standing committee called Measuring Success to look at performance measures across the early learning system. But one of the things that committee is tasked with is making recommendations for revisions on hub metrics. We did an extensive survey of all the hubs on the strengths and current of weaknesses of the current metrics, and also have done a number of in-person sessions with the hubs to get feedback. And our goal is to bring some recommendations in either May or June of this year to the council to revisions. So now I'm going to get to my stronger editorializing part. I think before you even get to the question about are these the right set of metrics or not, there needs to be clarity about what's the function and purpose of a set of metrics. And to be honest, I'm not sure that we had always been fully clear about that ourselves with the council and with the hubs on some of those roles. So, you know, I just put up here a couple of roles that metrics can play. So, you know, there's always signaling priorities. What is the work? Where should we focus? There's the adage, which I think is incredibly true. What is measured is what matters. It really tells people where to focus. Metrics can also play an important role in where are we succeeding, where do we need to concentrate more energy or resources, where do we need to make course corrections. And there's also can be a role for metrics and accountability, you know, which I know is a very important question for this body. Do the state get what it's paid for? For reasons I want to talk a little bit about, I think given the sort of state of the work, given some of the state of the work of what the hubs are focusing on, the state of what's measurable, the inclusion of accountability in one of the roles for the metrics, I think, has actually been really challenging and has caused some challenges over the last couple of years. So I want to talk about both why I think that's been an issue, and as also as a division, how we're also trying to be true to our responsibility and accountability and take a slightly different approach to sort of answering that question of are the hubs working and is the state getting what it's paid for. So I think, you know, part of the there's a little bit of, I think, history here that's also important for understanding the current state of the metrics. So I think, you know, the hubs were created in a little bit of that spirit of it was called tight on the outcomes, loose on how to get there, that the state is purchasing a set of outcomes, that performance metrics, baseline targets define what outcomes the state is purchasing, and you know whether you got what you paid for by you look at the end of the 2 years, did you make your target? It's a pretty clear and simple model and very straightforward for accountability, but I think for a number of reasons, it's not a model that's really works fully well at this stage, given what the hubs do and where we are in their hub, in their development. That's something. And so I think one way to sort of talk about what are some of those challenges are is to have a little bit of a comparison with the CCOs, which I think were created under a very similar, some similar models and thoughts. So, and this is just, to be honest, this is my own reflections on thoughts on to what extent, on how the CCOs are both similar in initiative and different from the work of the early learning hubs. The idea is that for both is to be regional and community owned, to change the focus to really on population level change, and to really focus on outcomes rather than outputs, and then also to similarly to really put the focus on upstream prevention versus downstream remediation. I think those are really core values for both the CCOs and for the hubs, and I think we really stand by them as really an important focus for why we've created hubs. But I also think there's some real differences in the way that CCOs and hubs function that make the that really impact how we think about metrics and performance metrics and the role of metrics and contracts between them. And those are I've put on the right, which is that, first of all, children and families don't enroll in a hub the way they enroll in a CCO. This is and I think that may sound like a small difference, but it's a really huge difference because the CCOs know exactly where their patients are, who they are, and can track them over time. And in some sense, one of the things I think makes a hub potentially really powerful is it allows for the first time, you know, if you're running a program, your first and foremost question is, are the families that are enrolled in my program, are we doing well by them? Are they getting what they want? Is it making a difference in their lives? But there also really needs to be someone who's asking the question, who aren't we reaching? Why aren't we reaching them? But the truth is, that's an incredibly important question, and I think and I'm really excited for the role of the hubs to do that. But the children and families that we're not reaching are also children and families that we can't track over time and don't have real data about. Second, as I already mentioned, hubs are not direct providers of services in the same ways that CCOs are. So, you know, for a CCO, you can, you know, I don't want to give an example here because I'm going to get something medically wrong, but you can imagine, you know, that there's particular treatments that CCOs do, and you can measure whether those are successful because the patient's enrolled and in tracking this, and Representative Huffman could probably help me out here on those examples. And then as part of the CCOs also have that global budget, which the early learning providers don't have. They don't have that same global budget. I think for very good reasons, we continue our OPK funding directly to those OPK grantees, our Healthy Families dollars directly through our Healthy Families programs. And then hubs focus on building alignment and connections across sectors. So there's a little bit of that kind of collective, or more than a little bit of that collective impact model that's really at the heart of the hub work, which means that hubs have really quite limited authority over CCOs or school districts or local DHS offices. So it's a nudging, cajoling, wooing kind of role rather than a command role. And I think those all these things, I think, have impacts on how we think about what's the role of the metrics, and also how do we tell whether the hubs are being successful, because I do think that is a really important responsibility that we do have with the public dollars that are invested.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Huffman.
Question. Thank you. David, do you track, is it insisted upon that the hubs are participants in the CCO's CAC, the Community Advisory Council. Is that a requirement? Or I know in North Central,
To be honest, I know the reverse question. So all the hubs are required to have health sector representation on their governance boards and work with CCOs. I don't know the answer to the reverse question. So that's a good question. I'll make sure we get back to you on that.
No, North Central, the Gorge Hub or Four Rivers Hub and the Gorge CCO, Krista's represented on the CAC. But yeah. I just wondered. If that was around the state,
I don't know if it's true for all of them.
It's a you know a phenomenal partner dynamic in the CAC.
Yeah, and that's what this work is really about is building those kinds of connections. So I think I've really talked about all of these elements of why I think the sort of what you might call the contract model for performance metrics is really challenging. I do think that the metrics, though, have played a really important role. As I said, part of the way I've been sort of thinking about a little bit of where we are in the role of the metrics is a little bit shifting the focus from what I'm calling for. This may not be the best way to describe it, but it's the way I've been describing it, moving from a contract model to a compact model, that the metrics, in some sense, are that shared agreement between the state through the Early Learning Council and the Early Learning Division and the hubs about what we're focusing on, what we're partnering with, and they play that really important role in signaling where the shared work is. I think in some sense because originally there was more of an emphasis on the accountability role, it sometimes created too much tension around the metrics and sometimes less led to creating an incentive to the hubs for more short-term thinking about what's going to move this today so I meet my terms of my contract. So in general, I've been sort of thinking as we move the shift, it's not to completely abandon that accountability discussion, but more, as I said, of the compact model of this is our shared agreement about what we're working on and how we know that we're moving forward, and a little bit less on the weight on that sort of contract model. You just look at the data at the end, and therefore, you get whether you got what you wanted. But that raises the question, how do we know, if the metrics aren't fully telling us at this stage in development whether the hubs are fully succeeding or not, how do we know and how do we tell and how do we maintain our responsibility as a division to the legislature in ensuring accountability for these investments? I think this is particularly true thinking about that role of the hubs and that collective impact model about bringing folks together, cross sectors, how do you know that that's really working? So I think what is the key question at this point in the development of the hubs, given that this is the first contract cycle in which all of the hubs will have been up and running from the beginning of the biennium? And, if we sort of look at that focus on collective impact, cross sector work, to be honest, I think the only way to know whether a hub is really succeeding in building that shared vision, getting people to work together differently, to invest resources differently, is to ask the people, the partners in the community, that question. And so what we've also done in the division, and we're really in the middle of this, is developed a hub monitoring process to go along with the metrics. And I think this is, and I'll spend a little time talking about the monitoring process, and I think it's going to give us a really different and I think quite, I'm really hoping, a pretty exciting, meaningful picture of what the hub work is meaning in communities. One that will help us answer this question to you and to the Early Learning Council about are hubs doing what we ask them to do and which hubs are doing what we ask them to do. But I think it also provides a real opportunity for self-reflection, learning, and self-guided improvement for both the hubs and the Early Learning Division. So I'm also really excited by the information that we're starting to get back from this. So we are in the middle of our hub team, so I was doing this. and our hub team is two people, to be honest. is Julie starting to do these site visits where we provided an opportunity to both do that sort of bureaucratic state contractual, did you meet your requirements, you know, do you have your reserves and those kinds of questions, document review, provide some opportunity to provide narrative questions on the work. But I think what's really been exciting about this step is part of this process for this hub monitoring has been a survey that the hubs were required to send out to all of their key partners in the community. So we both mandate a set of partners that have to be included. You have to include your OPK programs, your relief nurseries, but also gave the hubs the opportunity to self-identify additional partners that they wanted to be part of that survey. I believe Representative Huffman actually received one of these surveys.
And filled it out and sent it in.
Good.
Excellent. And so what we did is the hub sent out the survey, but the survey information went back to the division in such a way that allows the partners to actually provide this information anonymously to the division. I think that's really important at this stage to get that kind of honest feedback. We got about 590 responses. I should say not all 590 are fully filled out, but there was at least 590 folks who did at least the first couple questions. And to be honest, I think the extent to which a hub got surveys, got back to us, and got members completely filling out a survey is also really important evidence about the level of engagement from community partners in the work. The survey is quite extensive, but I just gave you four questions that I sort of pulled out from the survey to ask you, to show you some of the questions that we asked as part of that survey. K-12, Human Services, Healthcare, and Early Learning all participate in the governance of my early hub. Do you strongly disagree? Disagree? I don't know what this means. As community barriers arise, I take them to the Early Learning Hub for system alignment and shared problem solving. I think this is a really important question. Are people now starting to think of the hub as that place where they turn to get problems solved? Parents and families' voices are heard and affect my Early Learning Hub strategies and decision-makings. I invest resources in kind and financial and shared activities or goals with my Early Learning Hub. This is just a few of a much bigger partner survey. But as I was saying, I don't think we can really know objectively how a hub is doing in a community without hearing from the community partners and hearing from them in a systematic way. There's also lots of opportunities in the survey for more open-ended questions for people to providing us additional information. And we've also given people the opportunity to say, if this is information you want us to be able to share with your hub directly, let us know and we'll do that, because the hubs are really excited to get this information. So this just gives you a little bit of a sense of the timeline. As you can see, that we're really in the middle of this. Our hub team of two is in the process of starting those site visits. We're still working through some of the sets of surveys. 597 surveys is a lot of surveys. And the goal is to both provide us an opportunity to work with the hubs to develop quality improvement plans for each of the hubs. And just to be honest, and on the accountability front, if there are hubs that, you consistently see a pattern where they have not connected with key community partners, that may be something we need to take to the Early Learning Council as part of our debrief to the council.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, David, I wonder if it's possible to invite members of this committee on a site visit when a site visit is being done in an area. Is that too sensitive, or?
To be honest, sorry, I'll refer to my form. Chair Lively, Representative Kinney-Geyer, my honest answer is yes. Mm-hmm. I think what we're really trying to do is provide that meeting to be an opportunity where there can be back and forth between the hub leaders and to really work through the responses to the community. I'm not taking part in those, and our hub team has a trusting relationship with those hub leaders. We will be, and we're not there yet, having summaries of these hub by hub that we could share with you when we're prepared. It's probably more likely to be May for that.
I can report that since I serve on the Lane Early Learning Hub, I don't know, it was 2 years ago, the first time they did site visits, I participated. And I know that made it somewhat uncomfortable for some of the members just because I happen to serve in the legislature too. So I agree with David, I think, to have those frank conversations. It's best we not. But there's other opportunities.
Maybe after that, we can each on our own contact our hub.
Absolutely. Oh, sure. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. So, David, you mentioned the tight, loose issue, the comparison to the CCOs. After now having been in this as long as you have and been involved in, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I guess I kind of do. If you were to reflect, are there some significant changes or a few things that you might have done differently? Are there some things that we should be looking at that could make the hubs better that we haven't considered? I mean, you've got a different lens than anybody, I think, that you have a unique perspective and that you've been able to look at all of them and see this work.
Chair Lively, Representative Hack, yeah, and the sigh was a deep reflection sigh.
I want you to know that this is where this needs to happen. So I know I agree. I am kind of putting you out there, but we can't get better if we don't have. If you don't feel empowered,
No. And I'll I think one mistake that we made from the state, and I'll be honest, is I think some of the confusion around role of the metrics and accountability did create both too much angst and at times short-sighted behavior on hubs. On I need to meet this metric, and so I sort of thought of the metrics as line of sight, that you sort of stand back this way and you think about what's the work that I can do to get there. And I think sometimes when you talk about metrics as accountability, people go like this. What's the thing I do and what do I do tomorrow? Yes. Yeah. So I think there's some communication and shifting the focus that we could do from the state part that I think will help the work. I think one of the really challenging parts of this, and it's not quite going to answer your question, community relations vary from community to community. Different hubs have different strengths in bringing people to the table and measuring those relations. And I think we as a state are still trying to figure out what is our role in that mix. And I think part of the reason that I'm really excited about the hub monitoring process is, as we're saying, we do have a role to address this question of not just as a whole are hubs succeeding, but which hubs really need to do additional work. But at the same time, I think it becomes complicated if the state gets involved too much in trying to mediate those community relationships, and then it doesn't become community-owned. And we're still working through that. In terms of where the work needs to go next and how we can really strengthen this, I think one of the real challenges, and again, I don't feel like I know the answer to this, I think we've really moved quite far in bringing new partners to the table in new kinds of ways. What I hear on the ground about the collaboration between early learning and K-12, I think I hear consistently over the last 3 years, wow, that's a different conversation than we ever had. I think that's starting with Health and Human Services. I think that's starting with DHS. How do you move to that next level that's sort of, for lack of a better term, more operational? I think is one of the next big challenges of the hubs. So, for instance, I think what we have seen is great progress in developmental screenings happening in communities. When we dig a little bit deeper, what we know is there's still a lot of children who are missed between what happens in the medical office, getting that family into early intervention, early childhood special ed, to be assessed, and then when they're assessed, if they're not eligible, connecting them with other services. How we move past, I think there's all that work of we've built new relationships, and that's the precondition for that harder work. But I think there's also some real specific opportunities to drill down deeper that we still need to work on. I don't know if I answered your question at all.
Yes and no.
Okay. And I'd be happy if you have a follow-up question to push me farther on that.
I am going to push you farther.
Okay.
So I think there's more in there to go. I'm not sure if we do that at another time or...
Yeah. What I will say, and I really don't mean this at all to be a dodge, I really mean this seriously. I think with the hub monitoring, the hub partner survey is going to give us a real fresh set of data that's more comprehensive to really be able to say, these are the systems where the hubs have made breakthroughs. These are the systems that are partners where they really haven't, and something needs to be done. And I think part of the challenge is you hear a lot of that anecdotally, but to be able to look at that in, I think, a more objective way, I think the hub partner survey is going to give us that really clear picture that I think will allow us to really drill down. And then if there are some communities that we really do need to push, I think a set of data that allows us to do that pushing.
I appreciate that. Thank you. That I wanted to hear that you were going to be, that you were willing to take a harder look. And isn't that, I'm not being critical at all. I just know that each community is very different, and I think each one has to be pushed kind of in its own way. But, and I appreciate that your perspective on the matrix and the importance of it, but I also think that it also has its own set of barriers, but at the same time, there's an accountability piece that has to be there between the state and the funding that goes out. But I also needed to know that there would be a further accountability, I suppose, in a sense. I don't really want to put that word on it because that's not really what I completely mean. But each community is so, so different, and they're going to move differently. But at the same time, we still have to be looking at each one of those.
Yes.
And not being afraid to say that there's an accountability piece that might look a little different, but each one has to have that. So I appreciate that.
And that's the end goal of the hub monitoring process. So when we go to the council in June, we will be going hub by hub. And if there are some, if there is a hub that needs a strong quality improvement plan around a particular set of work, based on that work, that will be brought to the council with the goal of that being part of their contract moving forward.
Representative Hack, that's what this policy committee is about. So I expect before we even get done this year, even though we won't even have the results back, that we'll have some recommendations and directions for changes or modifications. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. And thank you so much for this presentation and the ones that you have delivered earlier. I'd like to drill down into budget, if we may. We went over budget when one of your first presentations, and there was something that kind of stuck with me, and I haven't been able to make the time to get a hold of you and kind of...
Chair Lively, Representative Brocksmith, we actually have a meeting, I think, scheduled on Monday.
Monday. Yes. So we're going to go through the budget.
Oh, but no, we have actually also a one-on-one meeting scheduled on Monday as well.
Oh. Well, there was a $34 million, if I remember, to run the program. $34 million of your budget was administrative for 113 FTE.
So we have a $400 million budget, $30 million of which is operations.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
How many? And so we can. I guess we can talk about it Monday if you'd like.
Yeah, so I appreciate, so we are going, we, this committee is going to spend Tuesday going through that.
Okay.
And I appreciate your questions about that, but we'll have a chance as the whole committee to deal specifically with the budget part.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before I move on, there's a third part of this, which is SB 213 from the 2015 session authorized us to conduct an outside evaluation of the hub system. And I really put the emphasis on the system as part of that due to the lovely challenges of contracting, we're just moving forward with that really right now with Education Northwest as our contractor for that evaluation. And when I say system, I think that's really important because part of the monitoring process, as we were talking about, is to be able to say hub by hub, what are the strengths and weaknesses of each individual hub? That's not the goal of the hub system evaluation. In fact, I actually think the hub system evaluation is much about the early learning division and whether we're doing the right things or not to support the hubs as it is about the hubs themselves. So that's why I really, for that piece, put the emphasis that's about the early learning hub system, and we are part of that system, and I want to make sure that we are evaluated as part of that. So that, and the goal of that is to really get at some of those, see if there's some broader recommendations about strengths, modifications, improvements that could be made to this as a system. Oh, and actually, that was really it. This is sort of the current timeline. So we actually, this is a little bit confusing because the final report for the evaluation by legislation is 2019. Since we had 2 years of funding in our budget, our current contract with Education Northwest goes through June 2018, but the assumption would be if that funding is continued for the 2019, we would continue that contract for 2019. So we intentionally also wanted to give enough time to really to have an outside evaluator really be able to look at the both the evolution and what it looks like when it's standing in order to make meaningful recommendations.
Okay. Any further questions for David? Doesn't look like it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you,
David. Sure. So I'm going to close the informational hearing on early learning hub metrics and monitoring, and I'm going to open an informational hearing on committee review and information presented, discussion, next steps. And so what I'd tell the committee first is David can attest that we're now having these discussions that we're having at the committee on the Ways and Means sub. Those that have been around a while know some of my frustration sometimes is what's a policy committee and what's a budget committee, and Representative Huffman can relate to this. It turns out they're the same because now much of the questions you're asking that we are asking to have David's making the presentations on the budget for this, and a lot of the same issues come up because it goes back to our, you know, our money being invested and what are we getting for the money. So it's kind of an interesting and I was hoping we could have had more of a conversation before we got to the sub, but we'll be well in before we start voting on it. So the idea for the policy committee, of course, is we don't ultimately control the budget, but we certainly set policies in that and make recommendations that would increase the budget or decrease the budget potentially. So it's not always clear in what those areas are. But so the goal today is have a conversation. So what we've heard to date, what are some of the issues raised? Are there other things that we want to make sure we get covered in the time that we have to cover them, and not necessarily just really taken care of this session, but get it teed up? And then where are those critical areas we want to really focus into from a policy standpoint, where we might think we want more information, we might want to suggest legislation, we might want to start talking about legislation for another session as we move through this? Because obviously we're early in this whole evolution of that. David's talked about some of the issues and what they're doing, but at the same time, we know we have budget constraints that are really putting a lot of questions before. I can tell you on the Ways and Means sub, it's clear there's wide support for what we're doing. Everybody understands the value of investing early. So that's not the question, but it just goes back to the money that we're spending and the programs we have. Are they doing what we want to? So what we thought we would do is go through today kind of the areas that we've gone through and some of the areas identified. And I really encourage people just, I understand this is a public meeting, but just to be honest, and there's no rights nor wrongs. You're entitled to your opinions, and let's just get them out there, because if the goal at the end, I want to make sure this committee has provided some direction to the legislature over where these programs are going and what we need to do to strengthen them in that, not that we'll solve them all right now. So I encourage you just to put it out there when we have the conversations, and then we'll see where it goes. So, yes. Oh, Representative Malmstrom.
Are you asking at this point to throw out?
No, we're going to start, and I'm going to go through, and what I'm going to do is just talk to the categories and see if we cover everything we've kind of covered to date, and then that's exactly right. Put it out there. Questions we still have, issues that were raised, and we heard some issues as people were testifying that might be concerns we'd want to address, and just make sure we've got those, and then we'll develop processes after that. So the first part was the early division and council, so we had the overview of what the division is and the state council that oversees the department. And remember that, so the director is appointed by the governor, and then the council oversees it. So this division isn't part of Oregon Department of Education. It's not part of HEC. It's not part of any of those others, so it's a separate on itself, and it does have a council that oversees it, and obviously it's all part of the bigger education thing. But so that's part of the whole thing from a structure standpoint. Does that structure make sense, or doesn't it make sense? And are the things we're concerned about what that is? I don't know if people have any questions or concerns about where we're at today with that structure.
Who decides who's on the council?
Who decides who's on it? Since you're sitting there, David, do you mind answering that?
So the council members are appointed.
You have to come up here and answer, so it gets on the... Nice try, but... And you don't have to introduce yourself again. We know who you are. Thank you.
I'll think of myself as permanently on the record. The council is appointed directly by the governor. There are a number of statutorily defined positions. So there needs to be representation from every congressional district. The state adopted in House Bill 4165 that the council also meet the requirements of the Federal Early Child Advisory Council. So the Head Start Collab director is a mandatory member of the council. And then we also currently have the Deputy Superintendent of Instruction, Director of DHS, and Director of OHA are also members of the council. And there's a couple other membership categories, so Head Start grantees need to be represented as well, and things like that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Concerns in that area? So we talked quite a bit about home visiting programs and the importance of home visiting programs. Specifically, some of the things we talked about was provision of culturally specific programs, trauma-informed care, and we're going to have a presentation soon on trauma-informed care and how that fits into what we're doing or not doing. Others do access to dental services. The whole area, again, outcomes, so what's our expectations out of home visiting and what are the outcomes? Significance, and we heard most recently, significance of parent engagement and how that plays a role in it. So issues or concerns? Representative Hayden, please.
There are some issues around some of the stuff that we're doing in the healthcare arena as far as sealants go. I don't know if you want, those bills would typically come to healthcare. There's a bill that has to do, that we're working on, that has to do with the historical requirement of sealants to use a certain type of product. Mm. Those were written a long time ago. We have new products, specifically meaning that the sealant product that is required to be used does not bond in an environment that has moisture. Mm. You're trying to do this in the mouth. You can imagine that you can't put a throat pack and gauze in every kid's mouth and have them breathe through their nose. So those sealants have a higher rate of failure. We have new products now that allow us to do those in moisture-heavy environments that work, but we're not allowed to use them as the requirements under the administrative rule. So I don't know if that's a subject that we want to, you know, that's getting kind of detailed. Mm-hmm. And whether we want to steer that, that's a bill that will be coming forth, whether we want to tackle those kind of issues here or not. I'm not sure the scope of what you're looking for.
Well, and that raises an interesting, because remember, so we're early childhood and family supports. And so in many cases, it all relates. I mean, certainly the health of the children and all of those things. And so at some point, those would cross. It's not clear. We've talked to the speaker about which ones do or don't. I think over time more of them will, just because of how they interrelate and the importance of doing multiple things. So, you know, from my standpoint, those should be on our list of things to ask about and see ultimately, because that's important to their success if the sealants are done correctly and they work. There's the other issues that they...
You know, in a lot of the healthcare stuff, we like to put language in that says the most appropriate product.
Yeah.
Because then that keeps up with the time, right? So, anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's pertinent here or not.
I don't think any of us know for sure. It is pertinent from the standpoint of the long, how the program works and that. But I think it goes back to one of the issue you raised about, we talked about the CCOs in the role. In some hubs, the CCOs and the work are working closer together than others, but the whole idea of a person on the advisory council, and I think Representative Kenny Geyer can attest that they're not all on, but that's probably a good idea. So from the standpoint of our conversations, and that might be one of the things we want to look at pursuing, because to help make that bond between the CCOs and that a more direct link, because there's certainly a direct relationship there. Okay. Anything else about home visiting? Early learning hubs. So we just heard...
I'm sorry. Can I go back one?
Yeah.
Home visiting. So I remember years ago there was a lot of friction between the healthy families and the nurse family partnership. That seems to have worked out really well, mm-hmm. which is great, and I asked a little bit about it. I'm still not entirely sure how they figure out which gets this child versus another. My impression is that the nurse family partnership only works in larger metropolitan areas and has a higher acuity level to justify the higher cost per child of their program. But that's a little, I want to make sure that we're making those programs work together and possibly sharing a database.
Sure.
I think they've made a lot of progress. I'm not totally sure if there's not more to be made or they're where they need to be.
Sure. Representative Malmstrom.
To your question, a nurse family partnership only takes first-time parents, unlike healthy families, and they also take OHP clients, mm-hmm. and where healthy families can take anything else. So there's been, mm-hmm. at least in Multnomah County, there's been a plethora of people, so there hasn't been, that's been easy to divide. But I think that which your question leads me into a kind of a greater question, is about waiting lists. Mm-hmm. My understanding was these programs aren't supposed to have waiting lists, but that was even on the presentation, was about waiting lists. In reality, it happens, and
right.
things come in waves. They don't come in neat little streams. And how is that being dealt with? Because when the minute you delay people, there's an urgent moment when, you know, need comes up. You want to get them into services, and how do you manage that? I'd like to hear more about that.
Okay. Yeah, I think we'll not get off at this point with that. But I think that's a valid question, that we need to pursue that more, and not just in this area, but others, this whole
right.
waiting list, because
right.
what we know is we're not able to serve all of those that should be served, so in any of the programs, so that's going to be ongoing. So we just talked some about the early learning hubs, and we've had some of the hubs come in and make presentations. David talked about where they're at in that, how we measure, we don't measure. So it goes back to, part of it goes back to, and we heard this some in our budget discussions this morning. So is 16 the right amount? Are they configured correctly? If you look at the configuration of the hubs, they had some pretty strange configurations, just if you look at land areas and how they got put in. We heard from the person from Eastern Oregon talked about the difficulty given the geography of it, but we also know from a population standpoint, there's a small population. But so I think there's some questions around mm-hmm. that we need to be aware of. Representative Malmstrom.
Right, thank you. And to that end, we touched very briefly on the fact that Multnomah County doesn't have a
right.
hub. I'd like to explore more about that. Yeah.
Anybody else want to explore more about that?
Well,
go ahead.
Chair Lively, yes. However, I don't know if it's better that we do that when we're back in our district, because we're a standalone with that, than occupy this time.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the best is.
So, and perhaps we can chit-chat a little bit about that and maybe go visit some of our county commissioners and make an appointment?
I think I'm
sorry.
Comment
James, no, I saw you waving at me. Good to see you. Nice to see you.
Wait a minute, we haven't got ourselves in too deep yet. No, go ahead, David.
So, I just want to correct for the record. There is a Multnomah hub, early learning Multnomah. So there is a hub in that region. That's mm-hmm. And the
name
United
for the
Way
record, is, in case we forgot.
Is the yeah, is the backbone organization for that.
But I think basically it was one of the last to finally get together, at least from the Portland metro area. It was a slow starter.
Well, it was in sort of the middle pack, yes.
And okay, thank you. So, but there others had raised the question. We actually talked about having the Multnomah hub come in, and so we may yet do that from the standpoint of the committee, just kind of bring us all up to speed to where it's at and what they've done. Because others have asked that, and that we just hadn't decided yet whether to do it, but it sounds like there might be reason why we would want to do that. Representative Kenny Geyer.
So I was just going to say that, that I hope that this is part of the survey and then the site visits question about how the hubs feel and how the people they serve feel about the geographic boundaries that they currently have, whether they should be tighter or looser. It seems like a good time to recheck that every few years when you're going through this process.
Yeah.
I think so. We're always going to have a different opinion that appears on that, and there's no magic mm-hmm. answer ultimately, and part of it is just the geography of the state and the population thing. But that does kind of go back to a question that Representative Hayden raised earlier when we first started this conversation about investments in rural areas versus the metro areas from the standpoint of how we invest those funds. And if the amount of investment, quote, is the same per capita versus that, we may not be able to get the kind of results we want there because of the low population or poverty issues. And that doesn't necessarily directly relate to hubs and how they're configured, but it does relate to what we're expecting as far as results and how those investments are distributed. Representative Brocksmith?
No.
Oh, sorry. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm sitting here thinking is similar to that question of how the resources are distributed. On the chart we saw today, we talked about delivering services to opportunity families. And I'm wondering what the cost of being an opportunity family really is to the state. So I sit on this committee. I sit on the higher ed committee. You know, some of you probably sit on, like, housing and human services. So I keep feeling like there's this layering mm-hmm. of us trying to take care of opportunity families. And yet, when it comes to a family, we all have the same basic needs, right? So even I, as a parent, still have needs of trying to figure out how to do discipline or how to get meal times to go better. So I'm kind of looking for how much are we spending on trying to target the opportunity families, and is that a fair distribution throughout our state mm-hmm. for all families? So that's my thought.
Good question. But that further points to the complexity of the system, because while we have this early learning division and we're focused from 0 to 5, we're not the only, and that goes back to what the hubs, part of the role of the hubs is to coordinate those things and to make sure we are. But then you have the overlap with so many others, and then continues on through school. So at the end of the day, the state, we ought to be concerned about the total. That's right. Absolutely. Are we getting the best for our bucks?
I agree with Representative Bynum. I'd like to look at those overlapping layers and see if we're, you know, we've talked about this in the past, and see if there's been, if our money is being spent efficiently, rather than having these multiple administrative levels of.
That could take about 20 years, but could.
No. He's young.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I would like the opportunity to have some presentation to us on the market-based ERDC rate setting. There's three zones of zip codes that are separated out in Oregon, and within those zones, then they separate that further out into three categories of types of daycares, which the rural communities have a hard time even qualifying for the highest type, and whether our formula to spend that money is fair or whether it in fact keeps areas in poverty and keeps areas that aren't in such poverty at a level, and whether our philosophy and policy behind we're going to pay market rates everywhere is really equitable or not. So I'd love to hear more about how that accounting is done.
Okay.
No, how do we do that?
It's on the list.
It's on the list, and I understand, you know, today in the budget we got quite a bit into the employment-related daycare and daycare in general, the access to it, what it costs, how we regulate it. So I think that's, again, we need to have more conversation about that.
You know, the conversation isn't more or less budget, it's how it's distributed.
Oh, no. Yeah. Right. Valid question. Okay. Anything else under the hubs we have questions about or clarifications?
One other quick thing as far as kind of looking at efficiencies, particularly in the metro area, people can move not very far and be in a whole other hub. And in my experience has been there's a lot of confusion as people switch back and forth and back and forth and a lot of wasted effort. And I'm not proposing any solutions here, but that would be one way I think we could somehow save some money if we were more efficient at that.
Sure. There was actually a question in the budget committee today about hubs being able to serve outside of their
right
areas. No, so that came up this morning. So that's another area we can talk about because that's not what happens.
Because people can move to the apartment complex across the road, and now they're in a new hub. You know.
Sure. No, that's valid. Okay. Preschool Promise, Head Start, Oregon Free Kindergarten. So we know that first in that whole area there's far more children need than there are programs. So that part, I don't think we have much to do over. But the question is, since there's different programs there, are they, one of the questions is always, do they compete somehow for the same employees? That's still a question around Preschool Promise in particular. How do those programs work together? The good news is that the way the Preschool Promise is delivered, multiple people provided. In fact, some cases Head Start is, schools are, so there's a wide array of that. But there's still questions around, given the number of people that we should be serving, kids, and these programs, are they structured correctly? Are they focused in the right ways? Is there something we can do differently that would help provide more access, I assume, other than just money? Representative Puffman.
Mr. Chair, there has been a work group meeting. Elise Brown, Justin Rainey, you know, some of the players, to discuss some of the challenges of placement and the number of slots. And they're very close to an agreement.
Okay.
And Justin is actually getting an amendment sent to LC this afternoon describing what their procedure is going to be moving forward. So we'll probably have that here in the committee one of these days to be looking at.
Sure. We knew this is the area where the issue came up over disparities in pay, depending on which program they are. And once we started Preschool Promise, it created another whole level of what the requirements were there. Pay is different then, and so that's created some struggles in the field. I know there's a bill.
2013.
What is it?
2013.
That's right. So we'll be getting a bill soon. I know it's been first read, and so it'll be referred to us when we get a chance to talk more about that. But that's a big issue.
Yep. Yep.
Both a big issue from if those are what our expectations are, that then how do we make sure others have the ability to get those credentials if they're working in the field and don't currently have, and then how do we make sure they get paid for that? So we'll be talking more about that issue when that bill gets here going forward. But that changed the playing field quite a bit, and we did that. Anything else in there?
Not without warnings.
No, I know. That's exactly right. Not without warnings. Anything else with the Preschool Promise, Oregon Free Kindergarten, Head Start in those areas? Other than the fact that there just aren't enough opportunities. Okay, then the workforce and child care subsidies for families. So we know we talked a lot about the high cost of child care. Representative Hayden, yes.
I have a input on this one.
Okay.
Again. Sorry, but I like this concept. Been working with Representative Kenny Geyer in trying to figure out all the nuances of being able to provide monthly payments of child care tax credits, both refundable and unrefundable. We provide parents or the appropriate people with those payments in a lump sum, and it can be thousands or even in some cases tens of thousands of dollars. We've tried twice to move this legislation forward, have continued to work on that over the interim with legislative counsel, and we do have a letter this time, and so we've worked with Oregon Department of Revenue, worked with legislative counsel, worked with the advocacy groups at length, and are still trying to do that. I've met with Clyde Psyche even recently. He still is supportive of the idea. We did have communication with USDA and got some verification that the advocacy group's concerns were correct, but that also those rules allow an exception to that, which would accomplish the goals. Understand that we're under a new administration, so I've gone back to Lori Freeman and asked for her to get a re-verification under the new administration, and would like to hear that bill, which will be forthcoming. Mm-hmm. They're working on it right now as a priority bill. The concept is, if we're giving $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $10,000, $14,000 for child care in a one payment method to somebody that needs that child care, that it may not get spent monthly for the next year. Right? So we're putting it on the responsibility of the parents to hold that money for the next 12 months. Not only that, we're taking the money from them out of their current paycheck, holding it for 12 to 18 months, and then saying, okay, now you can have that money and save this for your next 12 mm-hmm. months of child care. Mm-hmm. The cash flow, that makes no sense to me. Oregon Department of Revenue has pushed back on the idea because it's more work. Okay, I get that. Clyde Psyche is willing to push forward with a pilot program. So I'm hoping we can get that and have an honest discussion. We've had communication, again, with USDA on whether we can do it or not. We have a new administration, but I'm going to keep fighting for it.
Good for you. No, I look forward to that discussion.
I was just going to say thank you to Rep. Hayden on this. This was a very bipartisan effort. We had Rep. Parrish, Rep. Tobias Reed, I think a couple other people on it, and he's really taken the lead on it. But it's really, when we're talking about the high cost of child care, to ask the low-income families to basically wait 15 months. They have to wait for the year in which it's eligible, plus they have to wait till April when they file, and then they get a lump sum. And if we really truly mean for these tax credits to help people with the payments of child care, why aren't we doing it as we go? And, you know, likely it would be held back somewhat. It wouldn't be 100% payment, because if it's found in the end that their income went up or something. So we're obviously looking at those kind of sideboards. But if the point of these tax credits is to help families be able to maintain work, put their kids in child care, then let's make them work. Because ERDC, of course, is a monthly payment directly to the provider, the child care provider. And this is...
We're talking about tax payments or tax credits, some of which are refundable.
Right.
So they get the money.
But you have to have worked to have EITC.
And they get the money. And the pilot project didn't, to be fair, the pilot project doesn't include EITC just because we wanted to prove it could work. If we can prove it could work and open it up to EITC, I mean... Then we're really changing people's lives. To me, that's what it's all about. And it's just a matter of a cultural change, I think.
Cultural change.
Well, yes, and I misspoke in the EITC. It's the Child Independent Care Tax Credit. But like the EITC, you have to work in order to earn that tax credit, because it's off of your work. Yeah, so...
And that goes back to the conversation we had when we were talking about ERDC, about how that works, and especially as people's income raises, but it may not raise the level they can afford it, but they fall off the program in that. Right. So we'll have so that kind of helps supports that. But we'll have more opportunity to talk about that too, because we do have a bill talking about increasing the investment in it. But I know we heard that in the sub today too, about that issue of how that works and what people pay or don't pay. And obviously, there just isn't enough money there either. But I like
but
the
again,
tax
this
credits.
Is a distribution, not a change in liability or tax or however you want to look at that.
Just how
distribution issue.
Mr. Chair, can
yes.
I
But I, Cedric's looking at me because he thinks I'm laughing. You know, I was thinking of my own experience with my youngest daughter. So not everybody has a dad that can be a bank to bankroll them for 6 or 8 months to get back around, and then they pay you back out of the EITC or whatever it is.
That's right.
And so that goes on too in some cases, but for the young people that don't have the the bank,
that's right.
It is, you're spot on.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My thought was, I'm not sure what part of the age spectrum we're talking about, but a parent's child care needs don't end at 5. Mm-hmm. They likely end about 12-ish, 13-ish. And so...
26 by some standards.
Well, pretty much, right? And so what I wanted to... One thing I wanted to highlight, so it's March now, right? So it's summer camp time. Summer camp can run, $180, $200 a week. And you start multiplying that out, it takes a significant amount of money. So even families at the lower end, but even middle class families really struggle with childcare for the summer. So however we're proposing things to go forward, that's a significant issue for families.
So we did a lot of work in the Human Services Committee last year on looking at all the child care tax credits, and we combined the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit with the Child Independent Care Tax Credit, which is a federal. We had kind of a state alongside a federal, and we combined them. We did a variety of things in it, but in it, it does go up to 12 for all children with the income levels at ERDC ends at 185% of poverty unless you're already in the program, and then it tails off at 250%. It's a change we made last year so that people can feel like they can go up in their employment and still hold on to the ERDC, because it's important to have stability for their children in child care. But in this particular program, the rate at which you get it, I think, goes up to 250%. It's a declining amount that you get over how much the tax credit is. And it's also for other dependent care, which means anyone that's disabled of any age, if they're living in your house, or seniors, anyone that you need to forego. If you're working, then you need to hire someone to help. So it's the offsetting of your work expenses because you're taking care of a dependent. So it's a pretty broad tax credit, and we increase the amount that we are allowing for that, and we also increase the cap. It used to be up to $3,000 in expenses, so you have to turn in your expenses to get the credit. And it used to be $3,000 for one dependent or $6,000 for two or more. But we know that infant care, for instance, as we heard in this committee, is $12,000 or $13,000. It's at least $1,000 a month for infant care. But it does go for summer care and after-school care as well.
But thank you for reminding, because that's absolutely right. Sometimes we're thinking about just the 0-5, but you're absolutely right. Yes. You know, much through the early school years especially, there's needs for child care. And so we want to make sure any programs that we do don't mess that situation. Thank you, Representative Hayden, for bringing that forward. So anything else in that area of child care, families? Okay. Relief nurseries. So we have heard from the relief nurseries, and I don't remember the number, but there's quite a few relief nurseries around the state now that fall underneath the early learning. And we do know in the case of relief nurseries, just like so many other services we provide, there's more need. There's certainly need for more relief nurseries than locations we have. And I think what we know from them, from the standpoint they've been in business long enough, and that they have a fairly significant tracking system in that, so that, I mean, the outcomes and things, they can certainly demonstrate the benefit we're getting there. But other questions around relief nurseries, I know Rips and Peluso has talked about wanting to try to get one going.
Yep. And yeah, that's the next step, at least for Gresham.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there was a question raised at the relief nursery presentation, and this question applies to not just relief nurseries, a lot of things. So is early learning, and so early learning has grown from the concept to where it is today, and certain things have been placed underneath the Early Learning Division as being part of that broad spectrum of programs we're trying to offer. And so that specific question came up when relief nurses were presenting, is early learning the correct place for relief nurseries to be overseen? And I don't know where they started off before early learning. Were they just direct?
I think they were standalone.
Independent.
That's what I thought.
Yep.
But that was one of the questions.
But wait, David. Oh. David has an answer.
Oh, but that
you're out of order, David.
Prior to the creation of the Early Learning Division, their funding flowed through the State Commission on Children and Families, and they were also responsible for their rulemaking.
That's right. Thank you.
That is correct.
But so not just relief members, but others. But so part of this, as we go through and complete this year, and as we've looked at all the programs and how they're. We brought them together underneath the banner of early childhood or early learning. If other issues are raised, or there may be other programs that ultimately belong part of this when we're trying to coordinate and get the most out of our investments. So it's the only reason I raise that.
It'd be nice to know how many emerging relief nurseries there are. And then, in addition, what is the desire that may not be quite as far as being considered an emerging relief nursery yet, but...
Yeah. Certainly one of the things we saw about relief nurseries is the amount of private funds that they're able to bring to the table to help do it. And that doesn't mean there aren't others out there, but they do a pretty significant job of fundraising and helping to serve those. So we'll keep that's on our plate as we talk about programs and things. Are we structured correctly? Do the right things fall underneath? Are there other things that should ultimately be part of early learning? And this isn't, the idea here isn't to build a larger bureaucracy or administration. It's only from a coordination standpoint that we're getting the value out of those programs.
Can you repeat that part? The intent's not to create
the intent,
a larger
not to
bureaucracy.
Create the bureaucracy?
I have to.
That's hard sometimes, isn't it, John?
It is. They evolve, don't
yes,
they?
Yes, they evolve. K to 12 connections. So part of that's hub related, but so obviously what the work early learning is doing is critical to ultimately success through K through 12 preparing people. So the difference across school districts and pre-K, so this kind of goes back to some districts are investing in programs, some aren't in the position to be able to invest, some districts are creating space for programs run by other people. So there's all kinds of different models here. I think we see the values in those, but I don't know if there's other questions. And the equity question is always a big question on all of our programs, but access to preschool. So I don't know if there's other areas, concerns that were raised as we had those conversations or questions we have.
That's in the bottom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking about this on the drive home. At what point do we have a community expectation that a child is to be schooled? Right, so a lot of families, especially like in my community, we have a lot of families from China, and the first 4 years of life are spent with the grandparents. Mm-hmm. And so then they arrive at school on day one, they're healthy, they're loved, but maybe they don't know their alphabet.
Sure.
And so is that the community expectation that kids know on day one how to find their name, how to sit in a circle? And how far back are we pushing the schooled experience? What do we want as a state?
That's a very good question, because it's only recently we've gone to full-day kindergartens. Mm-hmm. Now, since we, in theory, have full-day kindergartens, so the next step is the years before that. And the problem is there's a wide range of programs in that, but it isn't anything consistent about it. But the question becomes, that's right, how far back do we? Some school districts are indeed getting into pre-school and starting to set up those programs, but not all school districts are, so not all kids have opportunities. But the question is even more about, how appropriate, how far back do we go?
Can I comment on that?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair. So, and David may want to comment on this too, but that's really where the conversation, I believe, started with the whole pre-K promise and bringing that to the forefront with the hubs, because we had such an issue in our school system with kids coming to school not ready to learn. And it wasn't just the behavioral issues, it was just they just weren't ready. And with the larger class sizes and the demands on kindergarten, back in the day, if we showed up and we were ready to sit in a chair and we knew our colors and we could tie our shoes, we were ahead of the game. It's so different now that you know, we've, that's why we really had those conversations. And not only is it, you know, the preschool, but we've now have the toolkits that go out to daycare providers saying, please do these minimum of things to get the kids ready for preschool. And you'd be surprised at what that minimum is. It's much, much different than what we had when we were getting our kids ready for kindergarten.
I know when I was at the national, so my first session, I went back to a national meeting with the National Council of State Legislatures, and it was on early learning. And there was, we had several presentations and talked about the question you were raising there. So how far, part of it is the whole environment has changed so much and yep. families have changed so much, that's great. But there's a concern about too much, if you go back too far and put too much structure, that there's a whole bunch of childhood and things, there's other things there, so there's kind of the balance. But I don't know that as a state, I don't think we have a clear where we think that magic is, though I know some school districts in some areas are trying to do more pre-kindergarten, make that available, but that's, I think that's part of our discussions we need to have about, you know, because if it's a value we hold, then how do we ensure all kids have access?
Right.
Back to how do you do that, and so
and not take that away from parents,
and not take that away from parents,
because kids still need to be kids.
Right.
So how do you find that balance of saying, wait a minute, we still need to let them be kids and be with their grandparents and do those yeah. things, but yet still have them ready, and finding that balance and hard. But I think those are great conversations.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about that. That's a great question. Anything else for the K through 12 connection, kindergarten? No. And early intervention in special ed, which is the one we heard most recently, obviously one of the questions I know that we all have on our mind is, since the programs specifically are required to serve every child, that's the requirement, but that doesn't necessarily bring more money with it. And so what we saw was indeed the fact that all children get served, but they don't get served at the level that the professionals know need to be in order, you know, the number of days they get visited or where they go to the home. We saw out there that the end of those most severely needing service, in many cases, we're getting the least amount. So that's just part of it. Goes, unfortunately, it goes back to a funding issue, but that from a policy standpoint, it kind of goes back to the same question, though. So you pass, the policy says you got to serve every, should that bring with it an automatic
yes.
requirement for funding?
Yes, yes.
Agreed.
Well,
isn't that much money? It makes such a huge difference.
It should.
Can well, but it should,
it
shouldn't
so?
It?
It should.
It should.
I'd be happy to work on something to make that happen.
But I think we should.
And I think...
So, go ahead.
Well, Chair Lively, I think it was evident in looking at the numbers, it wasn't IEPs. A lot of
no.
money difference to make a huge yeah. difference. I mean, I think that... I think we were all kind of sitting here going, wow,
yeah.
It really wasn't that significant to realize that, man, you could make a huge, huge difference. So... That was an education for me. I didn't realize that, you know, that they were receiving such little services, and it really wasn't that much more of an investment.
Excuse me? Yeah. That's, I think it was all for all of us. That was kind of, but that kind of goes back to this, the whole budgeting process and how decisions get made, and that's part of the, hopefully, the value of this committee, that we can work on position. I'd love to be able to have... some way to commit future legislators to a funding level, but I don't know that we'll get quite that far.
Good try. I was just yeah. going to put three other things on the table, and I'm sorry I had to step out for a minute, so I don't know if anyone else said this, but I think the whole workforce discussion is really important, so I want to make sure that we revisit that, and what I don't know to what degree it's policy, budget, or what, but
right.
That's a big issue. Foster kids. Mm-hmm. We haven't had a special thing right on foster kids, but certainly you know from being on the Human Services Committee, it is a big issue in our committee, but my committee is a policy committee, not a budget committee. We don't have anyone from the Human Services Committee on the Human Services Sub because they meet at the same time. And the more that we can get people up to speed on really how horrific our foster care system is, we're by many accounts 50th in the country. We had a federal audit, and they had 14 different recommendations, and we didn't make any of them. And we are the parents for these kids when they fall into the system, and certainly we want to do as much as we can in these other programs that we're focusing on here to keep kids out of the system to begin with. That's the focus of this particular committee, but my committee, since it's Human Services and Department of Human Services, gets the kids that have fallen into it. And the more that we can do, and there's a whole bunch of, you know, recommendations, but I think if, especially because you're on the sub, so that's good, but I don't think there's anyone else from this committee on the sub, and there's no one from the Human Services Committee on the sub. And so are you on that too? Oh, that's right. So the more that we can... you know, have a voice on that committee to speak for these kids who really, you know, are some of our absolute most vulnerable Oregonians. So that's another thing. And the third thing I was going to say is probably a more controversial topic, but I don't think that we should stay away from that. This committee tends to be more harmonious than anything else, so I don't want to shy away from hard topics. But the what we do about the 17,500 children who are undocumented, who are here, living amongst us, going to schools, counted as part of the, 40-40-20 and everything else. You know, I maybe having a session on that so that everyone's aware of it, because it's something that we will probably all vote on, and the only committee that ever really gets to hear about it is the Health Committee. So I would offer that as suggestions.
Thank you.
Going forward.
Sure.
Join us March 8th in healthcare.
March 8th in healthcare. Representative Broxton.
Well, no, I remember it was a teaching moment from Representative Hayden to myself and paying attention when it was, I believe, $3 million that was always needed to be added to double the amount of workers they had. Do you remember that in the presentation? You had spoken about how you already have the initial costs in the administration, so
right.
In order to double the service.
Yeah, they're receiving somewhere around 9,500 and change, and they need for the children in the individual education programs, and they need to get to $10,243 or something like that. So percentage-wise, you're talking about, you know, about 6% increase would be able to not double their staff, double the time that the staff could interact on a weekly basis with many of these children. So you're just doing a small tweak up, which gets them some more FTE on a system that they already have. And I don't have the numbers memorized, but I think it was about a 6% increase would get them where they're asking to be. Seems like a simple ask to me. Let's do it.
Yeah,
seems like
to
me too. It's a simple ask. Okay. Any other questions, concerns? I would just go back. This reinforces how the budget discussions are not clearly just budget. They're also policy, and we set policy by how much money we invest or don't.
That's right.
And that's why, to me, it's important, this committee, that we talk about those things and try to influence then those budget decisions, because otherwise it's just a dollar and cents decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we'll get a chance next week to hear from David once again about the budget specifically, and then we can ask our questions specifically about the budget and where the money's going and all of those things, if he lives through the subcommittee first. Anything else?
Here in the legislature.
Okay. Not for the journey.
It's an honorary legislator. Thank you. David gets an honorary legislator. Thank you. David gets.
Not.